Welcome to the Full 60 featuring Craig Custance and presented by The Athletic. Each week, we'll dive into the biggest stories in hockey while bringing in unique voices to entertain and explain all aspects of the game.
Hey, this is Craig, and welcome to this week's episode of The Full 60. I am excited to have a guest who I've been wanting to have on this pod a long time, and now we have this opportunity, taking advantage of every spare moment during a very weird time in the hockey calendar, in the hockey world. Mike Fiuta, who is a longtime executive with the Los Angeles Kings, who is now, Mike, what would I say, a free agent? What would be the best way to put this?
UFA.
UFA, unrestricted free agent. I didn't know how it worked after July 1st or what the ruling was.
Well, you could say unemployed, but UFA sounds a lot more official.
No, unemployed as long as you want to be unemployed, as far as I'm concerned. A UFA, an executive UFA, and we can get into this in a second because it's a weird time. There's a few people in this spot. But yeah, so just for the listeners, so Mike was a huge part of building the powerhouse Los Angeles Kings, broke into the program doing a lot of scouting and draft evaluation, part of the group that drafted guys like Drew Doughty, Tyler Toffoli, Tanner Pearson, that whole crew, Wayne Simmonds even, that ended up being a big part of the Jeff Carter trade, right? I'm already trying to think about that. And, you know, won multiple Stanley Cups, a guy that's widely respected in the NHL circles as an executive, as a talent evaluator. Mike, thanks for doing this.
Absolute pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
So let me start here because it is a weird time and all of us are trying to just figure out what our days look like. What do your days look like? What are you up to right now?
I could not describe them any different than the old, I guess it's a cliche, but Groundhog Day. Well, for me, first of all, I left out Los Angeles. It would have been early March. There was rumors like I have three young daughters that live in Innisfil, Ontario. And I had heard rumors through the Canadian government that the borders were going to shut down. And I was still with Los Angeles at the time. And I thought it was very important. My parents live in Midland, Ontario, that I get across the border before, it was still a possibility. And I remember packing, I didn't pack a lot because I assumed I was coming back just for the story carries on. But we, I went to Air Canada. I booked a flight. My flight had been canceled 4 days in a row. I got there. I mean, I've become second family with the Air Canada staff at LAX from the amount of times I've flown out of there. But I literally went there and it was like a ghost town. That was on the Dreamliner. There was only two attendants working. I was one of five people on the Dreamliner. Business class to myself, which I initially thought was pretty cool. Then when I saw everybody putting their masks on and somebody rolled two bottles of water, I had this big picture of me having a couple quick glasses of wine and tipping off, and they threw me a box sandwich and a couple bottles of water. In incubation until we landed, and then I got back in Toronto and the police came on board and had us fill out these forms, and I'd heard all about it. I mean, I'd done my homework. I had a friend, Blair MacArthur, who had an empty home in King City, and I had to write down the address and quarantine for 14 days. And he's a great friend. He's got a beautiful place that had a gym inside, which saved my life because I would have lost my marbles. But my friend Quinn Moyer left some groceries outside. I did my 14 days quarantine and then head up to my parents, drove past, said hello to my daughters because I still had to get through some quarantine issues before I could see them. But it was crazy. So, I mean, I got there and then about 2.5 weeks into my stay, I received a call from Rob Blake that I was no longer going to be a member of the Los Angeles Kings, that they weren't going to be picking up my option. And I still had about 2.5-3 months left of my contract. So that was a punch in the gut. It was a tough emotional feeling for me. I've only been a part of one NHL team and shared a lot of fond memories and success, but it is what it is. And then from that point on, it was strange because in my position, I had initially been told that, I mean, teams didn't need permission to call. You always, in the management industry, if you're getting a call, the team's got to talk to Los Angeles for permission. And then Brian Burke said, he goes, how do you put it? You get your, I received some really nice phone calls. A couple of them were work related. He said, you're going to get about a bunch of pity, what do you call the pity calls where, you know, you were
the pity calls,
the pity calls where everybody's thinking you're great, you're gonna be only, you know, you're gonna be awesome, you're awesome, you're best, you're gonna be hired, you're gonna be hired tomorrow. And those keep coming, and they get to a point where you're like, this is really pissing me off. I mean, these are starting to really bother me. And then 3 days later, they
stop. Sorry if I was part of any of those pity calls.
No,
Mike,
that was
I take
fine.
It back.
No, but it's because then 3 days later, they stop, and you're like, why is nobody calling?
I need a pity call.
So it's absolutely at Berkey. So it was hilarious because at Berkey and all his fond ways of putting things was basically describing how the thing was. And then you get him throwing in a couple of good. I got some great stories from guys about. You know, I remember Ronnie Francis and Berkey and Dean Lombardi, the guys telling me different stories about how they were fired and not, or their contracts not picked up. And I think the one thing, once you, I mean, I'd be lying to you if you're not angry, you're disappointed.
Sure.
It's not the way I wanted my stay with the Los Angeles Kings to come to an end, but it also reminds you how many people's lives you've affected and how many great friends the industry and the business has brought, from the players that call you, from the employees that you've, you know, helped open doors. I mean, I had so many people help me open doors to get to the National Hockey League. And when your friends start to call you, whether it's just staff, I mean, there's probably 10 or 12 people that I had hired or was a part of the hiring process with the Los Angeles Kings who were still there. And it's just an emotional time all around. And you get angry, you get sad, you get emotional. I think you start chomping at the bit. But like you say, Craig, this is like no other time. So it's not like I've always preached, and I think we always try and preach that hockey's a game where we talk about we and you don't try and talk about I. But when you lose your job, you start to think a little bit more about I for the first time. I mean, it's the first time I've ever been let go in the National Hockey League. And it's not in it from an ego statistical standpoint, but you've really got to have the confidence and look at what you've accomplished and what you've done and the doors that you knocked down to get there, to know how confident you are you're going to get back. And the only thing I'd say right now, the difference is, if it was a normal hockey, a normal hockey world, or just a normal world, I feel pretty comfortable. I'd have a new logo and start a new pastime.
Sure.
But unless you're, I mean, I'm convinced you could be Scotty Bowman with Joel Kimball shoved up his ass right now. You're not getting hired in the middle of a pandemic.
No. There's not a lot of hiring going on right now.
And that was the part, I guess, for me. And that was part for me that I felt it could have been handled a little bit better given the timing of the pandemic, because nobody was really, it wasn't really a favor to do it at the time you're doing it, because it wasn't. I mean, I had some really positive hockey conversations, but they, I mean, 85% of them end with feuds. We can't do anything till we get started, till we know what's going on. And that's the nature of the game right now. And it's and I can look myself in the mirror and feel sorry for myself. And that's not going to get me anywhere. I think it's trying to be ready. I've studied. I mean, part of the Groundhog Day is continuing to study. I mean, I've all my draft notes ready and to roll as far as this upcoming draft. I've gone over. I've had some really positive Zoom interviews. You can't meet anybody, so it's not like you can get over the border to sit face to face with anybody, but just going over, you know, what I've learned, what we've accomplished, you know, the great mentors that I've had that have, you know, really reconnected with me going through this, as far as, you know, it's more like, it's funny when you're happy at your work, I think you're always learning. And you're evolving,
right?
And you go in every day, and you're learning something new from somebody. And I guess that'd be the best way to describe. And it's funny, Craig, because it didn't end great with myself and Dean Lombardi, right? Like, we were like as close as thick as thieves. Like, it was, you could say I was his, whatever, Tonto the Lone Ranger. I don't think there's two people. He connected me with Mark Giannetti, and Mark Giannetti became my best friend in hockey. But Dean Lombardi and I, his mind. Like, I used to think I knew what I was doing in junior hockey, and he challenged me to another level to draw out different aspects of myself and my ability to evaluate a player and team build and just, you know, establish character. And we decided defining a culture, but he made me such a better hockey person. And I think at times I hope I helped make him a bit of better guy, but I mean, he learned a lot from me as well. And at the end, I think it was just one of those things when you've gone through the trenches together for so long, sometimes you just need a, I was devastated when he got let go, but it's like, maybe this is a good time for a fresh start. And then you kind of go your separate ways. And then you start to think about, you know, how incredible. And you see these teams that are winning and how much they're accomplishing, and you remember how long ago it seems, how far off it seems, but they can't take that away from you. And I think for to be able to reconnect with Daryl Sutter and Dean, and not sit there and have one of those, like, there's going to be a day 20 years from now where they're going to, you know, they'll have real guys and they'll have numbers up in the rafters of the Los Angeles Kings of guys that are, they've won championships there, not just Hall of Famers that had incredible careers. And I think those are the ones that are really going to set the path for what that team accomplished, and to be a part of it. And then to just know, just, you want that next challenge. The problem is right now, nobody's playing hockey. So right. I have to be challenged getting my ass kicked on a golf course, or getting beat up at 21 by my daughters in the driveway, yeah. Or just spending. The one thing I will tell you is I'm very fortunate to still have both my parents in my life. And you know what the hockey travels like for the last, yeah, whatever. I mean, I laugh because I forgot what Christmas was with World Junior Championships. It's, those are really the 2 days. You go home really quickly, you unwrap your gifts, and then you decide which World Junior Championships you're traveling to. And there's really no time to just enjoy your family. And the one thing, I mean, I'm divorced and I don't see my kids as much as I'd like to see. It's a joint custody. But I mean, as far as my parents, it's been amazing. Like, and I'm not going to, this time, if there's going to be, I hope there's more than one positive out of it, but the biggest positive has been the time I've been able to reconnect with my mom and dad and enjoy them and laugh and just share. And it's hilarious because my mom is the biggest Kings fan ever. Well, she's probably the biggest Mike Feuda fan, but it's led to a tributary that goes to Los Angeles Kings. And if you were to walk into our basement, like, I've had the pleasure and the humbling experience of twice bringing the Stanley Cup back to Toronto, and then our basement is literally a shrine to the Los Angeles Kings. There's pretty much a jersey of every player that they drafted, like whether it's Simmons or Shannon, or Ron Hextall, guys that I've worked with. There's the banners from the parades. She's got my rings, my cups, everything. It's for me, it's because that just shows how much my parents love me and my mom loves me. But yeah. I snuck down and she was taking Rob Blake's jersey off the wall. And I was laughing so hard. And I'm like, it just tells you it's not any right. Because listen, you're not going to find a better guy than Rob Blake as the personality and stuff like that. But it was funny. That's just your mom's take on things. And she left Luke's up. So Luke's still good. But I
said, so Luke's okay. I wonder why Luke escaped the wrath.
Now, Luke's pretty good at that.
Luke's
pretty good at that. Luke. But he came out of it pretty unscathed. But it was one of those things. It was funny. And I made her put it back up. Because it's part of the history. I say, we'll build a new legacy with, you know, for our family with another organization when we get started here. But it's just a funny story based on your, how much your parents support you, whether you're Pee Wee Minor Adam or a 52-year-old executive that just got let go.
Yeah, right.
Or not renewed. Right. I like the not renewed thing. That's pretty good.
Renewed. They didn't pick up your option. That's it makes it sound like, you know.
My friends, I've got a lot of very passionate friends. They don't use that term.
They don't like renewed.
They've been waiting for their ears to chirp me, and now I don't get a lot of renewed out of my close friends, but that's what hockey friends are for. It's the chirping.
That's right. They keep you humble. That's right. It's funny though, like for you to say that about your parents and having that time, like that's, I was just talking to my wife about this, like this has all forced me to like stop and like, I'm just going to enjoy like today and the time I'm having with my parents or my kids, where I always felt like I was thinking of what was next and what's to come. And hey, we've got the playoffs are starting or we've got a draft, and I'm constantly thinking about, you know, maximizing the future. And it's really like, this has forced us to stop and say, okay, hey, what are we doing today? And what, you know, that we wouldn't have the chance to otherwise.
And you just said it, and it's, I think it's for everybody. I mean, it's, you can't help but think about it, but it also is when you've worked your entire, like I was educated as a teacher, right? And I never taught a day in my life. I was very fortunate that hockey went well very young at the, you know, I went, played in Europe, came back, and I was hired by St. Mike's to coach the Buzzers, and it's, you know, kind of spear jumped into the major junior team with the majors there. And I quickly learned that I was not going to be a head coach in the Ontario Hockey League, but yeah. I was having an expansion team. I remember Sherry Batson told me, he goes, you better get into management in a hurry.
Coaching wasn't working.
But, and I loved it. Yeah, but I mean, it was every day. It was more like, it was just, I've just incredible how much I just didn't like, it's one of those things like, hockey jobs, they're cool to have, but if you're not prepared for them, it's like you're doing, I said, it's like doing a 100-yard dash at the 90-yard gym. It'll hit you in a hurry if you're not properly prepared. And I wasn't properly prepared. I was named and I was passionate, but I wasn't ready to be a head coach in the Ontario Hockey League at 27 years old. I mean, I'm literally watching there, and thank God I brought in Mark Osborne, because I was like, I was running drills and my practices looked like a symphony orchestra, but it was like, it was more like a hockey school. They weren't specific right to teaching systems and stuff. And I mean, I was teaching the systems that I had been taught, but I mean, I wasn't, you know, people that can just switch and, you know, okay, we're going to play the 1-2-2. Why? Because that's what I teach. You know what I mean? It's not because you're reacting to what the other team, that's the way we were doing it. And have Mark Osborne come in with his mind and be such a great, well, other than being an incredible human being, he was such a, for me, it was just a guy that I was just learning from. Then I realized, I mean, here I was going out and enjoying finding the players and being passionate about it. But then when you're on behind the bench, you feel like you're shortchanging the players from what you're really, how much better. I mean, we got great relationships, but as far as what they need to know about how much better coaches there were out there. And then I think I learned a ton too when I got, I mean, that was the only, when I was let go there, and that was writing on the board. I mean, you're 27 year old with an expansion team. I had the Sheldon Keefe, David Frost, fivesome there that were, I think, I'm surprised they had any hair left by the time they were done with me. And then I moved on with George Burnett, the Oshawa Generals, and I was his assistant coach, assistant general manager, and he was just a brilliant hockey guy. And that's when I started really going down the evaluation process with all the under-17s, and then it opened up some more doors, and it led to the job in Owen Sound, which kind of set the table for my job in Los Angeles, and it was just an incredible ride.
What was the moment for you where you realized, okay, like talent evaluation or being an executive, like this is where I'm supposed to be?
Partially with the draft and in Oshawa, just learning from George, just because the confidence he had in me with regards to how I think it's a lot to do with, and I think it had a lot to do with my father and stuff like that, the ability to publicly speak, but have substance to it, and to really make kids comfortable, not because you're full of it, or just because you make them feel, you do your homework on them, and then you get comfortable and you find out. I mean, I think at this stage, we kind of all know what a player looks like on the ice, but if you can peel back the onion and find a little bit more about what they're bringing out as a person. And I make people, by doing homework on them, and just whether it's a little bit of humor and knowing about their background, they open up and you kind of have a better idea of the character of the kid you're getting as well. And I think that was it. And then I mean, he pushed me in to get involved in the under-17 program. And then when I was named director of it, I think that's when it kind of hit home, because I now had NHL players that were like, I was never going to go back and sit in a room and sit there and tell everybody what it was great to be like when in the 93 series, when we played the LA Kings. I mean, my highlight, we won the Danish national championship. I mean, I was captain of York University. We won a university championship, but I don't have NHL stories to tell as a player. So I knew once the door opened for me as an executive that I couldn't shortchange anybody with my work ethic, or I had to have extra amount of respect for the game. I couldn't be out. I mean, I could have my fun, but I had to be coming in bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, not hungover and stuff like that. And I couldn't take any shortcuts. And then I found myself now speaking at things that ex-NHL players were kind of my staff, so to speak, in coming in. And then when you realize that you're nurturing them on the knowledge of this side of it, and I'm going to gain from the experience that they have as a player that you can't have back. And I think that's when that had that success. And then you start to see when you're no longer, you're with the elite in the OHL. I mean, my under 17 teams that were winning, I mean, the one we won the world championship with, I mean, it was like Stamkos, it was Tavares. Like, you're rhyming off. You're literally on the bench. Like, yeah. And I was actually coaching the 1 year, and it was unbelievable. Yeah. Like, I had Corey Perry, I think, on my third line. And I'm like, jeez. And I have to say, Paul Bissonnette was arguably our best defenseman. He says I have to say that every time, which says why.
I like how you threw it arguably, just to give yourself
an out. He ended up at that time, he was a very highly rated defenseman, and he ended up being a winger, and Biss was always Biss, but it was hilarious just how even those relationships start to develop. So then when you started to build teams, you already had seen the work ethic of a Stamkos or Tavares or Drew, or, and we had them all. Like, you're coaching these kids and then you're managing them. And then when we won, Marty Williamson was my coach. We won the gold medal, and it was like that team was just, it was unbelievable with Stamkos and Delzato. It was Delzato.
Yeah.
Insert. And then you see, it helps you when you start to know these kids at that level. When you now, like, I kind of moved to Owen Sound, and the first thing, it goes right back to what you're saying, Craig. It's easy to go into a job like that, and the first thing I could have done is hire all my buddies, right? And hire people are going to say, hey, Fuchs is the boss. And the first thing I said, I got to find an NHL coach. I got to find a coach that's been in the NHL. So if I go in and I'm either giving a life lesson or lighting up a team, I don't want the kid across from me to say, well, you've never been there. You didn't know it.
You don't know.
You're just winging it. Right. You read that in a book or something like that, or a coach's symposium. And it was funny because I golfed with, I went over my list of guys, because I think that as a manager, that was one of the most thrilling processes too, of going through the interviewing people. So I ended up, I think my Scott Arneil, I had Billy Armstrong, who I golfed with yesterday, was an assistant GM, Stanley Cup champion with the St. Louis Blues. He was one I had, Jeff Ward, who's now the head coach of Calgary Flames. Yep. These were the guys I was interviewing. And I mean, then guys like Rick Byfe, who I was like quietly trying to not ask for his autograph during the interview and stuff like that. But it's also, and that's the thing, when you start to see the people that you're interviewing and the respect they have for you. And Mike Stuthers was the other one. And it leads to the story, because in Owen Sound, I was like absolutely coming into a situation where had the best ownership and the best people in the world. Sherry Bassin had really opened up a door for me there, and George Burnett. And then I get there, and I mean, their list is like, here's the list of top 10 players, and here are the two little report to Owen Sound. And I had to kick down that door and re-jag the culture there. And they gave me like the keys to the car as far as doing it. And I hired Mike Stuthers. And part of the inside track on Stutz coming in was through Philadelphia. And I knew that Bobby Clark was recommending him to me. And on top of that, Bobby Clark was also at the time basically the surrogate father for Bobby Ryan, whose father was in prison at the time. And I felt that if there was any way, picking seventh, I could convince Bobby Ryan to come to Owen Sound, then the walls were down. And he had told everybody he was committed to Michigan. He was in the program. And I started that process of recruiting him quietly, and then we ended up picking up Bobby Ryan, number seventh. I remember bringing him up to Owen Sound on a recruiting trip in the middle of the summer, and it was the sunniest day ever, and tried to convince him that every day in Owen Sound is this
sunny,
not tell him that he's going to be, next time he comes back, he's going to be ice fishing in 6 feet of snow. it was an awesome experience. So and it's funny, because when I remember calling his name it was like a video draft, and I called his name and I called him immediately, and I had told the story 100 times. The owners were like, is he excited? And on the other end, Bobby said, I said, hey Bobby, we just drafted you this. And he said, oh, okay, I'm just playing catch outside, do you mind if I call you back later? And I hung the phone up, and the owner said, is he excited? God. I go, he's thrilled.
He can't wait.
I think he just hopped in his car and gave it everything. And then I was like, oh boy. And then we had to recruit him after Harder. And I had a good feeling with Bobby Clark involved that he was gonna be with us, but it was quite the process. And then the rest was, and then we had American players calling us to come up. I mean, Bobby was a star.
Well, I mean, I'm a college hockey guy, so I know how you guys do it in the OHL with the bags of cash and all that. Don't act like it was all.
Well, here's the best story, because I mean, I had to call Dave Branch, because I knew people were going to think there was bags of money involved with the Bobby Ryan. So I said, I had gone to a Billet family in Owen Sound who had a guest house. And I said to Dave, Bobby's dad's in prison. It's a well-documented story. I said, his mom needs to come up during the first year. How can I make this work? And we talked about it. And it was like, well, if his mom lives with the Billet family, that's the only way he could come. You know, just set something up where they're. So Bobby ended up living with Wes Cunningham and his mom in this little cottage, which was like a guest house. And the family got an extra 2 seasons tickets. There was not one ounce of cash involved in the transaction. And by the time the story got back to the Ontario Hockey League, I had built this house on the water. And Bobby Ryan, Bobby Ryan was living in a mansion on the water. And it was so funny because there was no way I was going to get through this. So I went to Dave ahead of time because obviously they wanted the best players in the league. And that was classic.
Right.
And then I would get it from, as I said, Mark Hunter would be like, oh, sure, Future, giving him barrels of cash. And I said, listen, Hunts, I'm running a respectable program here. You're the ones that are.
You're the Hunters. Ones
that got you got the players living in. I remember putting up, I remember David Boland telling me after the fact, and I don't want to get Hunts to call. I hope Hunts doesn't listen to your podcast, but
I don't think he does. So feel free to say anything you want.
I laugh because I'm sitting there and we're literally playing London in the playoffs. And we're putting up, like, my owner owned Kelsey's and Montana's. And we're putting up, like, coupons for Kelsey's and Montana's for who scores the overtime winner. And David Boland tells me, like, 5 years later that they had, like, 10 grand on the board or something.
Oh, my gosh. You're like, hey, you get 10% like, off your entree.
Yeah, I'm like, here you go. You guys get the smoky ribs if you tuck it in overtime. He gained so much respect for the Hunters because they're an amazing program. And I think Dale's an incredible coach. But that at least we've got the respect of the Hunters. And we're now part of the recruiting pinch. But no, junior hockey was great. It was a great, and again, I go back to that time there with that family. It opened the door for me. And they had some great players in the past. And we drafted Wayne Simmons and Mark Giordano. Andre Sekera, who came, it was like we were on board. We had Bob Sanguinetti had decided to report from the United States. And we were top players. We were now loaded up with top players. And it was a great run. And then, of course, I mean, the door that opened for me, I just signed a 5-year extension with the Attack. And Dean Lombardi, we had Trevor Lewis on our team. And it's a little quick story, but the Trevor Lewis, I went into an agency just before the draft, and I had noticed that Trevor Lewis wasn't on a Western Hockey League protected list. He'd been drafted, but he'd been deleted. And I went into the office and I ended up going down. I had contacted the Philadelphia Flyers, who I felt was going to draft him. And the plan was for the Philadelphia Flyers to draft him. And then I was going to try and convince him to sign an OHL card and register it with the office, because there was no ruling saying that you had to go through either league to do so. And so I'm at the draft, and Ron Hextall is now gone from the Philadelphia Flyers to the Los Angeles Kings. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting in the crowd going, oh boy. So, and it leads to a funny, because you'll remember the draft, Craig, because we're up there and the Kings, so the Kings take Trevor Lewis, and I'm like, oh boy. So I go over to Ron Hextall and I said, is this still something we can work on? I walked down the draft, first time I've ever met Hex. And he said, yeah, it's something we want to talk about. And then Philadelphia goes up and it's the draft, because I'm pretty sure they were going to take Trevor Lewis. And that's the draft where Bobby Clark walks up and forgets who he's taken. He was just ready to say Trevor Lewis. And he looks over and goes, who are we taking? And he ends up getting Claude Giroux. So it's a pretty funny story.
That's great. I'd never heard that.
No, it's hilarious. But so anyways, I end up getting Trevor Lewis. And Dean loved the fact that I'd found a loophole. Because he just loved the fact when the league had to change the rules now that so Spokane was rushing to get Trevor Lewis back on their list, but I had already signed him and registered him in the Ontario Hockey League. So Dean loved the fact that I found a loophole, and he goes, whenever you have to change a rule because of something you did, that's cool. So that kind of sparked our relationship. And then Dean and I, Dean and then Ron Hextall came up and we developed a pretty good relationship because, I mean, we had Berkey coming up to visit Bobby Ryan because he was with the Ducks, and I was starting to forge these really solid relationships with the agents. And then Hex came up and said, listen, would you be interested in leaving this to come to the NHL? And I was like, he said, it all happened. I remember y'all said, Hex, it all happened at Montana's. And then I was married at the time, and Dean was like, listen, come down here and interview. And I said, respectfully, I'm not just going to go as an area scout. If you have a better situation, I said, I got a 5-year contract here. I'm in a good situation. So he said, okay, what about director of amateur scouting? And I said, that's interesting. He says, okay, come down here. We're going to interview you. Pack for 1 day or 30 days, because if I hire you, you got to stay because the draft's around the corner. And then he pulls in, and at the time he told Mark Giannetti that he was going to be the director of amateur scouting, and Yank tells a story. It's hilarious. So he pulls Yank in and says, listen, how would you like to to be a co-director instead of just the director with Mike Fiuta. And Yank goes, well, I wouldn't really like that at all. And he says, well, what if you're going to get a lot more money? And he goes, okay, I like, he goes, first of all, it's not a question because we are hiring Mike.
Yeah.
And secondly, you're going to get more money. So it was hilarious. And then of course, Dean and his infinite wisdom was like, we started off his first meeting. He pulls me aside and he goes, listen, you only know the Ontario players. I asked you to do an Ontario list. You've got this guy, Wayne Simmonds, at number two in Ontario. He's not even on our list, right? He's not even on our list. We got a problem, right? And they, in fairness, he had made a complete turnover. So everybody was scouting and they were like scattered all over the place. So I literally, my first meeting, he walks me in front of the entire staff, says, and they kind of heard that I'm going to be the new director the next year. So they're already got their backup. Like, who is this guy? And then Dean literally walks in and goes, okay, this is Mike Fiuta. He's on board. He can only talk about Ontario guys. And he's got a guy at number two that you don't even on the list. And he thinks you guys are all idiots. Call me Dean. That's how he introduced me to the guys.
And that's so Dean. Oh my gosh. It's like the most so believable Dean.
So
story ever.
So it's just like, oh, so he's like, so sort it out, you humps, because this guy thinks you're dumb.
Right, right.
And then he closed the door and goes, well, figure it out, Peter. And I'm like, okay. So anyways, anyways, guys. So I put together this huge video thing together on Simmonds, and the rest is kind of, all of a sudden Simmer ends up at like nine on our list. And we're sitting there at the draft and Dean says, well, what do you think? And I said, well, we probably don't have to take him. It was the night before, actually. He says, we probably don't have to take him. Nobody even knows. Simmer doesn't even know. I told Simmer I'm going to invite him as a free agent. He doesn't even think he's getting drafted. And then Dean just starts screaming at me again. You hump. You can never work for me. You put a guy at seven on the list and you're going to wait to the sixth round to take him. You take him right where you got him on the list. So I'm like, okay. So here we are in the second round. And we'd taken Thomas Hickey, I think. Boys, we took him at three or four, something like that. And then we took Oscar Moeller in the second. Then we had a compensation pick at the end of the second. And Dean was like looking at me, if you don't step up to the plate here. And I said, yeah, we got to take him now. So they pushed the microphone in front of me like it was on fire. it wasn't with confidence. I went from just kind of sitting off the side like, and the Los Angeles Kings take from the OSAT attack Wayne Simmonds. My phone starts blowing up. Steve Spott sends me a text. He goes, I hope you didn't get rid of your home and Owen Sound. You're done. You're toast. So I'm just getting rifled from all angles. I think the only guy that complimented me was Pete DeBoer, but I learned a lesson. Dean said, you don't, right there. You believe in a guy. You put this, it's not you, it's just not you. You convince that whole staff with your video presentation. You know this kid better than ever. You know his character. You've done all it. If it doesn't work out, it's not because you didn't cover every base. You put him right where he is on the list, and you don't screw with the list. And it was perfect. And Simmer almost drove off the road. He wasn't even talking to me. He was so pissed off at me. Thought I left him in Owen Sound to just draw it. And all of a sudden, he's like, I got drafted when? Where? Second round? Second round, Los Angeles? And I was like, so it was great. I mean, and obviously, Simmer made me look like a genius because they said the kid shows up. He's, you know, just blows the fitness testing out. They were actually arguing whether they're going to send him back to junior for another year. That's the kind of impact he made. And in fairness, he looked like he was 156 pounds or something like that. But I knew what he was going to do. He's going to come in. He's going to battle. He was going to fight. He's going to work. He's going to make everybody was going to turn their head. And they sent him back. He never played a game in the American Hockey League. He went back, was traded, won a gold medal with the Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds. He played with the Sioux. He won a gold medal with Team Canada. Came back, made the Kings the next year. And I mean, he's 60 games short of 1,000 in the National Hockey League. He's been an NHL All-Star. And I mean, he's one of my best. I mean, he's the same thing. Those are the kinds of when things went down with me, when those guys called me, that you just really realize how much, not only, you know, I mean, it's what they do for you, but what I've done for him and how I've changed his life.
Right.
And he obviously put a lot of trust and faith in me, but I mean, I knew that he was never going to let me down with how hard he was going to work. And it's fun. And I remember Dean, it leads to enough because Dean, that's when we might, you actually prefaced it beforehand, because when we were really starting to turn the corner, Dean came in and he said he knew Mike Richards, who I'd coached at the under 17 program. And Mike Richards, probably one of my favorite players in all of hockey.
Yeah.
He said, listen, Fuse, we got a chance to get Mike Richards. He goes, but it's going to cost Braden Schenn, who was my guy in the first day. I just love center and Simmer. He goes, we got to trade your son, Simmer. And I go, well, clearly Simmer's not my son, but I said,
I said Jeff Carter. It was Mike Richards. That's
It was Mike Richards. It was Mike Richards.
Yeah, yeah.
But it ended up, so Simmer and Schenner went there. And again, I mean, that's why I was so proud. Simmer obviously became a huge part of the lore in Philadelphia. He still looks at everybody said, because we won our two cups. And then it's funny how these players critique themselves because Simmer used to here's Simmer now and Schenner tearing it up in Philly. And they're starting to say, well, look at this trade. Philly won the trade. And Simmer's like, well, that's bullshit. He goes, you got two Stanley Cups. We can put up all the points we want, but you got two cups in your belt. And Mike Richards was a huge part of it. So, and he was right. But it was like, and then, and last year, as you said, Schenner and I have kept in touch since the day he was moved. And he was like, and when he won that Stanley Cup, he called me right after the game and he said, I got one for you.
That's
and it
awesome.
Was after the game. I went to STK and I'm just sitting there because everything was packed and stuff like that. And I guess St. Louis was coming in to have their rookie party and they all walked by and Schenner, they went in the back room and Schenner gave me a pat in the back and said his hellos and stuff. And he said, sorry, Sheets, I got to get, we're having a rookie party. And I go to pay the bill and it's like, sorry, that gentleman you're talking to has picked up your, it's the respect awesome. And it's a little thing, but it's just you've had that kind of impact on him. And then when this thing went down with me, like Schenner's like, what's going on? It's like, these guys aren't talking to me. Like, and that's when players have and that's the ultimate thing. And you can't put it on your resume, but I think if you want to, in fairness, in my case, and I've got some incredible mentors and stuff in my resume, but it's the players, it's the players that tell your best story. Cause they know what happened. They know who's responsible, who did the groundwork and who laid the path and did the work. And I think, and that was what was so great about our LA experiences, because it got to a point we had such a strong development team that Mark and Eddie and I and our staff, we could go in and we could find somebody and we'd know, oh, we can fix that. The development team can fix that. And then you just hand it over to that team. And we had Dean was so far ahead of everybody on the development camps and the baseball model of working on individual skills and all these camps. Yeah. It was great.
Along those lines, I think Wayne probably fits into this. I remember, I think Lisa wrote the story, but this was something you would hear Dean say, or this guy's a culture changer. And that's a phrase. I think Dean's giving you credit for that phrase. Like, how do you identify a culture changer when you're talking? Because I think from the outside, if we're doing a draft evaluation, we'd be like, boy, this team's passing on these guys that are putting up all these numbers or look great. And this guy looks like a reach, but I think that's the outside thing we can't always grasp.
Well, Dean gave me credit for the term, and it was my term, but in fairness, he called Yank and I said, it wasn't like I pulled it out of, it's like he said, we got to change the culture around here. And then I got into this big argument about a certain player and he said, what makes him different? And I said, he's a culture changer. And then I just define I guess the definition of that for me is there's certain players that they belong in your list in a certain spot based on what they do on the ice. Okay. And then there's other guys that do certain things on the ice, but it's what they're going to bring, And again, it's that Justin Williams. Okay. It's the guys that have this special element. And when you sit down with them, they have it.
Right.
And this is before I was in the league. You watch, there's a scene that Philadelphia is playing Pittsburgh in I think it might be the conference finals, and the game is over. And I don't even know why these two guys are still on the ice, but Crosby and him are taking a draw. And I said to my dad, I said, Richie's going to either jump Crosby or spear him. The game's over. Pittsburgh had won the game. And sure enough, Richie, he just, there's a thing that you're going to do that it just, and he did, he speared Crosby and they didn't get in it, but it just, he sent the note. You might've won the game, but we're not going away. And it's, those are the kind of guys that you see them do that over their career. And I guess Simmer did it for me. Schenner, for me, Braden Schenn had that aspect, that element. But clear cut for me, Kyle Clifford is an example because people gave us a lot of scuff for taking Cliffy higher than that. And it was like, we had that spot labeled for Kyle Clifford based on when I met him, I said, you're going to absolutely love this kid. Like, I mean, it's the same thing. Everything about him is throwback. His work ethic, he fights, he scores, he comes from a small town air. He's going to come in here and change the culture. He will hold everybody accountable in the gym in the, everywhere. That's what he did. And it's just, I guess you can't, but when you sit with him, it got to a point, we hit it off so much that we sat, I said, Dean, when you meet this kid, and Yank hadn't met him, Mark Yanetti hadn't met him yet, we brought him in. And by the end of it, first of all, he almost pulled Dean's hand out of the socket, which is always good. And he had that big, but he had the dark eye, but he just was so honest. And then he basically told us he wanted to be an LA King. And I laughed and I said to him, okay, then we can't fix the draft in Los Angeles in the NHL like they can in the OHL, Cliffy. So what are we going to do? I said, I'll tell you right now, you have my word. If you're available at the top of the second round, you're a Los Angeles King. And I said, and now if you get drafted in the first round, Godspeed to you, because that's everybody's your dream. You're not going to tell somebody. Yeah. But I said, there was only three picks before we picked at the top of the first, top of the second. And the only player we had ahead of him on our list was Ryan O'Reilly. So the way that thing fell apart.
You guys came close on that, by the way.
Yeah, I know. And O'Reilly goes the first pick. I think he went, the Islanders took a goalie, and I think O'Reilly went next. And then it's only Atlanta. And Dean goes, oh, Atlanta. I go, we're going to be fine. I said, Cliffy went in there yesterday and basically threatened to beat up one of the scouts. He told me, I said, Futes, Cliffy was calling me, telling me who was, like, we were like walking it through. Yeah. I said, who's next? Yeah. He goes, Atlanta. He goes, no, I threatened to beat up a scout there. You were fine there. So I said, what happened? He goes, yeah, well, I knew if I could get past them, I'm an LA King. So the guy started kind of giving me a hard time. So I said, listen, you want me to throw you at a window? And then they kind of just quietly canceled the meeting. So we were sitting at the draft table and he goes, one more. And I go, we're good. He's not going to Atlanta. And I think, oh my God, I can't. They took this kid from Sweden that I was like,
I'm looking at it. Carl Klingberg.
Carl Klingberg. He used to wear the big Lenny McDonald helmet, this Klingberg kid. And I'm like, I can't believe, no offense, Carl Klingberg, but I said, I can't believe that they just passed on. And then Cliffy could have got up and started. I mean, there's two guys that knew, like, by the time, well, Drew obviously knew, but I mean, literally, I looked up and Kyle is already starting to shake his pants. He's supposed to wait for the name to be called. He was already hugging his family and making his way down. And it was like, this, he just knew. And it was honest. He knew I wasn't going to lie to him. And Dean loved it. And he said, there you go. And then he comes to training camp. All of a sudden, Dean used to say, you know, you don't know what it's like to get your ass kicked by Anaheim. They just physically abuse us. He goes, we need guys that are going to push back. And that's when we went about it. And the same thing that was with Tanner Pearson. I remember knowing we had developed such relationship and I had missed him. He was the last player on our list the year before. And then the next year we've got him in the first round and the guys were really struggling with it. How can you have a guy in the seventh round? Now you got him in the first. And I went, yeah, that's how far he's come. I said, that's how we got to get over that. Then we made a mistake. I said, he wasn't in great shape. He was injured and stuff. We can't just say we made a mistake. We're going to look bad. We can make mistake right, but guy plays and we take him in the first. And Mark didn't want him in the first round. He loved him, but he just didn't like Yanetti just didn't like the feel of him being a first rounder. And I stood up and we walked up and it was like Tanner already was ready to go. He knew he was going to be an LA King and that worked out very well as well. Another guy, Craig, there's a perfect example is a guy like Curtis McDermott. Okay. And I think if you know a kid as well, and cause you said, how do you know a culture changer? Paul McDermott was one of my owners with the Owen Sound Attack who played, and he was a complete throwback. Every guy that's ever played with him loved him as a teammate. So when I was up there, there's this little Curtis McDermott that his dad worked like a maniac. His brother, Lane, was in the gym tearing it up. And here's this Curtis who's about 5'6". He's got these eyes of like in the gym when he's not even. And over summer, I come back up there and he's now like 6'2", but he looks like he's about 110 pounds or something. And I'm like, oh my God. So I watched this kid in the gym and I came back and I said, Dean, I want to take Curtis McDermott in the seventh round. And this kid was playing junior B and he was not an NHL prospect, but I just knew that he was the hardest working kid I'd ever seen in the gym. He was, every one of the family ended up filling out into be monsters. And if he ever caught up with his body, he was going to, first of all, he's going to die in the train tracks trying to be a pro. And we brought him in and he was like, we went on the ice. It was not pretty. He kind of looked a little bit like Bambi on ice because he now was, he wasn't, he hadn't grown into his he hadn't grown into his body, his maturity. He was just all off. I had called him at the draft and said, listen, will you come in a training camp? And we ended up taking him and bring him in. We signed him as a free agent after camp. And Dean said, you promised me this kid's not going to make you look bad. And the kid's playing in the NHL now. And he's 6'4", 245 pounds. And he's a culture changer because if it was back a couple years ago when you could fight and hit, he'd be making millions of dollars. But everybody on that team likes him. And the same thing, he did. I mean, he did all the work. He wasn't going to make anybody look bad. And I mean, it's incredible. Right. He's, I would say, I mean, the other night when Milan Lucic woke me up in the middle of the night with Mark Giordano, I think we did discuss that he's probably one of those guys that Lucic says, when you go into a building, you better be ready, because he's that respected around the league now.
Right, right. How do you balance, and we almost got to wrap up here, but you've touched on so many things I want to get into. How do you balance, like, if you're looking at a guy like Kyle Clifford, you know, there's a certain ceiling to his game, right? Like in the second round, you know, he's not going to be a 40 goal scorer. And like, I'm looking at that draft, and let's say you have a skill guy like a Jacob Silverberg, like you said, like, I mean, either pick works. Like, how do you sit there and balance ceiling? Because this is always my argument when I talk to teams like about draft. Like, I would be trying to hit a home run with every pick, like skill wise. And I understand that's not how you build a Stanley Cup winner. Like, I get that. Like, how do you balance that when you're a draft evaluator?
It's a great question, but I think sometimes if you have multiple picks, it's easier to take a swing on somebody that their ceiling's higher. I mean, in that case, there's a guy, I can't remember his name. There was a Carl Alsner. Okay.
Okay.
You almost watched Carl Alsner in junior and said, this is exactly what he's going to be as a pro, right? This is exactly what he's going to be as a pro. Kyle Clifford, we had as he's going to be a third line guy that's going to go up and down. He's going to fight. He's going to probably score 15 in a good year, but he'll be your, every teammate's going to love him. So in that case, you're so sure on what he's going to bring to the table that you might take a player like that higher than somebody that you're like, there's a perfect example, like a guy that this guy might not play at all, but if he hits, he's going to score 30.
Right.
Right. And
right.
And that comes down to, it's the same thing picking positionally. And those are great conversations that we have. And I think a lot of cases, it depends where you're at as a team. Like, I mean, I remember the one year, I think it was the Rangers didn't have a pick for the first four rounds or something. And they took the Day kid out of Mississauga.
Yeah.
Who they thought was going to be a home run, and he's never played a game. So it's like they went.
But
for
you might as well take a swing if you're the Rangers, because we don't have a first round pick or first.
Yeah, that's
rounds,
the thing. If you
so,
if you have one pick, I think in fairness, I think without, I mean, I'm not talking out of turn, but I think San Jose did that too, and the one that they with Merkley, because everybody was running away from Merkley, and they were like, hey, if this guy gets it, he's going to be better than all these guys. Right. So you got to take that chance. And I think that those are the conversations that are have. And then you present all the information to your GM and go from there. But I mean, it got to the point with myself and Yank that if we wanted somebody and we wanted to move down or up, Dean just trusted us. That was it.
Yeah. That's awesome.
It's a great
Mike,
feeling.
I appreciate you doing this, man. There's so many things about the Kings I want to get into in that era. Like, that team, I got to say, was so much fun to cover. Well, not fun to cover in terms of interviews, because you could run into a Jonathan Quick on a bad day, or even Drew. But like, in terms of watching, like, that team come together and form, and they just became that powerhouse. I loved those Kings Blackhawks series in that era, and being a part of that just must have been amazing to kind of help build it and then watch the fruits of your labor play out in real time.
It was beyond. I mean, obviously the fruits when you as a kid growing up, you mean when you're picking up that Stanley Cup from Toronto International Airport and they open that thing, it kind of hits home. And then, you know, and then the second time you do it, you're like, hey, maybe this wasn't just luck. This is a pretty good group. And we went to the conference final in between. And I think the one thing about it that really, I mean, among other things that, I mean, especially when you go back and reminisce, and Dean and I have had a chance to do that it's really a shame the way it kind of came down, it ended. Because I mean, you look at now, there's a thing like nobody would ever think hockey would stop for a pandemic, right? Well, we had set ourselves up to have a shot at a couple more cups, and it was some poor off-ice decisions that ended up striking us down. I mean, Slava Voynov, and I love Slava to death. I mean, and I visit him in Russia and stuff, but I mean, Slava gets himself in trouble. Now you lose a guy that arguably was pushing Drew Doughty on night as a top right-hand shot defenseman. He was on a great contract. You know, Richie gets into his issues at the border there, and all of a sudden Mike Richards, and all of a sudden you've got a bunch of unforced errors that have put you in salary cap prison, and you can't get out of it. And it's too bad, but it is, they can't take away what that group accomplished. I think there's times, and you watch in the job that Daryl Sutter and John Stevens and the coaching staff, you know, Davis Payne and these guys, Jamie Compon and Bill Ranford, like the job these guys did, and to win it two separate ways. I mean, like the first year we go in as the eighth seed, and then we go up 3-love, 3-love, 3-love in every series. Like we were up 3-0 in every series. And then you're like, wow, this is that. I mean, they were grind. They weren't easy games,
right?
But you're winning.
Right.
You're never at that brink. And then all of a sudden, I think you're over, you've won the Stanley Cup in like 16 or 17 games or something. You're like, holy smokes. Like what happened? And then the next cup, the guys go 3 game 7s on the road, win 3 game 7s on the road. It's like, and I mean, and when you're on that plane and you see these guys coming up, pushing intravenous tubes up and down, they look like a MASH unit, like going back and forth to New York. And you got Jeff Carter and Jonathan Quick going by with intravenous and leg machines and stuff. You're like, wow, these guys. And you look how gaunt they are when they're done and when they've put it all in. And then you get, you damn right, you have every right to celebrate. But it was unbelievable. It was absolutely unbelievable. And it was those games with Chicago. I mean, that's one thing that's been, if not, I wouldn't say fun, but to go back and revisit that series against Chicago and all these, because everybody's got no hockey to watch, they keep reshowing the series. That's right. Just some kind of hockey.
It was awesome. It was fun to just watch and cover and be a part of, and it was great. I miss it now. I'm feeling like reminiscent towards it or nostalgic for it already. But Mike, thanks for doing this, man. I've got a notebook here, and I'm like, I've got a million other questions, but well, we might have to do a part two at some point. But
More than welcome awesome. To. For me, it's been anytime you get a chance. I mean, again, when the sport's taken away from you, you realize how much you love it and how humbling it is. I mean, and that's like from a pandemic circumstance standpoint and from a standpoint of, you know, going to be looking for work when we get started here. But I mean, it's anytime you get a chance to talk hockey and relive and talk about the future and how much positive, you know, how many great days lay ahead. It's exciting. So yeah, I really appreciate
awesome. It. Well, thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch. Thanks. Take care. We'll see you around.
Thanks, Craig. Take care. Bye-bye.
I want to thank Mike Fiuta for joining the podcast. It was awesome. And I know I feel like I say this a lot, that I always want to do a part two with whoever the current guest is. But in this case, I literally have, I'm looking right now at a sheet of paper with a bunch of questions that I didn't get to. We barely even scratched the surface of the Kings, that era of them winning multiple cups and some of the behind the scenes stories there. And not only that, like, I love talking draft and talent evaluation and what goes into that. And I could do that all day. So we're going to tuck that away, and hopefully we might bug Mike to come back on. Cause I think there's a lot more meat on the bone there. That was an easy one. So thanks, Mike, again for doing that podcast. That was awesome. A couple things before we wrap up here. I do want to encourage you to check out the Scott Burnside podcast, Two Man Advantage, with co-host Eric Duhatchik filling in for Pierre LeBrun. They had Doug Wilson, who was recently inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame, of course, the GM of the San Jose Sharks. Doug's a great talker, great guy, and it's an awesome episode. So be sure to check that out. Mark Masters, who another fun guy, joined Jonas and James Myrtle on Leaf Report. So I would encourage you to check that out. And if you are a Wild fan, always listen to Mike Russo. You don't even need to hear this. I don't even know why I bother plugging this. But Ryan Donato was a guest on Straight from the Source with Mike Russo. So check that out. And then last thing here, if you're listening to this on the Athletic app, we now have it so you can leave a comment and we can engage there. And so... And you guys have been doing that already, those of you who found it. So I would definitely check that out. Go to the app, go to the current episode, and leave a comment if you have questions about the guest or questions about the episode or just some feedback. And I did want Matt B on a few days ago left a question that I didn't get a chance to answer yet on the app. I'm going to do it right now because he said, "Hi, Craig. I tried Max during one of his Q&A sections," and he's talking about Max Baltman, our great Red Wings beat writer. "But I was curious if you knew why Yzerman was so defensive and standoffish when asked about Blashill coming back next year during locker room cleanout interviews." Jeff Blashill, of course, is the Red Wings coach who is coming back next year, whenever that may be. And I don't have any insight into why I didn't see the video of Steve Yzerman and whether or not he was standoffish. I will say this in general terms about Steve. If you're asking him to divulge information before he's ready to divulge it in terms of future plans, what he wants to do, and he's not ready to expand on that, I don't know if I would use the word standoffish, but he can be short. And you can ask a question 25 different ways. If he doesn't want to talk about it or he's not ready to reveal where he's thinking, it's not going to be a very long conversation. And my guess in this, without having seen his reaction, he probably wasn't ready at that moment to talk about Jeff Blashill's situation. And so it may have come off as standoffish. So Matt, thanks for the question. And thank you to everyone else who was interacting in the comments. So definitely check that out. Go to The Athletic, comment on the podcast episode. If you're not a subscriber to The Athletic, of course you can get 40% off by going to theathletic.com/the full 60. All right, that's it. That's a wrap. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks again to Mike Fiuta, and have a great week.